We all hear about life sentences, right? And you think, that's it, game over. But it gets way more complicated when you're talking about someone who was just a kid when they committed the crime. It really makes you think about this whole idea of saying someone's never going to change, especially when they were so young.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what makes this case out of Massachusetts, Diachenko v. District Attorney for the Suffolk District, so fascinating, I think.
Okay, so Diachenko, Massachusetts. Got it. Lay it on me. What's the deal with this case?
Well, it takes this huge Supreme Court ruling, Miller v. Alabama, which everyone's probably heard of by now, and kind of puts it under a microscope, but specifically through the lens of Massachusetts law.
I see. So it's about how states can sometimes go further than federal law when it comes to protecting people's rights.
Exactly. We tend to think of federal law as the bare minimum, but Diachenko really shows how states can actually offer even stronger safeguards. It's kind of a cool example of how our legal system works on these different levels.
That's really interesting. I never really thought of it that way before.
Yeah, it kind of flips the script a little, right?
Totally. So, okay, let's get down to the nitty-gritty. Who is this Diachenko guy, and what did he do?
All right, so we're talking about Gregory Diachenko. Back in 1981, he gets convicted of murder. He was only 17 at the time.
17? Wow, that's really young.
Right, and this is where it gets even crazier. So under Massachusetts law back then, that conviction meant an automatic sentence of life in prison without any chance of parole.
Whoa, no parole, like, ever. That's incredibly harsh, especially for someone so young.
No kidding. And to be clear, Diachenko did try to fight that sentence. He argued it was unconstitutional, you know, both under the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, that whole cruel and unusual punishment thing, and under the same kind of clause in the Massachusetts Constitution.
Makes sense. What happened? Did those arguments work?
Unfortunately, no. Those initial appeals, they went nowhere. It seemed like that was it for him, you know, life without parole.
Man, that's heavy. But you said things changed with that Miller v. Alabama case. Can you give us a quick refresher on what Miller was all about? I feel like I've heard of it, but can't quite recall the details.
Absolutely. Miller was a landmark decision by the Supreme Court in 2012. Basically, it said that mandatory life sentences without parole for juveniles, no matter what the crime, were unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment.
I see. So even if a 17-year-old commits a really serious crime, they can't automatically be sentenced to life without parole. There has to be some other option.
Exactly. The court's reasoning in Miller was all about how kids are different from adults. They emphasized this idea of diminished culpability. Basically, because their brains aren't fully developed, they're less responsible for their actions, you know, they have a greater capacity for change and all that. The court also said it's just plain cruel to condemn a child to die in prison without ever having a chance to show they've changed.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so how did this all play out for Diachenko? Like, did Miller automatically change the sentence?
That's where it gets really interesting. Miller created this whole new legal problem. Did it apply retroactively? Meaning, did it apply to cases that had already been decided, like Diachenko's?
Oh, okay, I see. So that's one layer of complexity.
Exactly. And then there's another layer. The Massachusetts Constitution, it has this clause about cruel or unusual punishments, too. But the wording's slightly different from the Eighth Amendment.
Oh, how so?
Well, the Massachusetts version prohibits cruel or unusual punishments. Notice that or in there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Eighth Amendment says cruel and unusual. That little or makes a big difference. It opens the door for Massachusetts courts to find a punishment unconstitutional, even if a federal court wouldn't.
So potentially even more protection under state law than federal law. That's super interesting.
Yeah. And that's exactly what the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court had to figure out in Diachenko. They weren't just deciding if Miller applied to Diachenko. They were looking at their own state constitution and asking if it offered even more protection for young people facing life sentences.
Okay, so double whammy, federal and state level. Let's tackle them one at a time. What about this whole retroactivity thing? That sounds like a pretty tricky legal concept.
Yeah, it can be.
How did the Massachusetts court decide that Miller should actually apply to old cases like Diachenko's?
Well, they basically said Miller created a new rule, a rule about what types of punishments the government can hand out. It wasn't just a procedural change. It really changed the substance of the law, especially for young offenders facing life without parole.
So a change to the actual law itself, not just the process.
Right. And the court said that these kinds of changes, especially when they protect a vulnerable group like juveniles, they have to be applied retroactively. It's about whether the sentence was legal in the first place.
Okay, I think I'm following. So what about the Massachusetts Constitution? How did the court interpret that cruel or unusual clause, and how did that compare to the federal standard?
This is where things get really interesting. The Massachusetts court kind of took the ball and ran with it. They loved the Miller decision, agreed with all its points about how kids' brains aren't fully developed and how they can change, but they went a step further.
They did. How so?
Well, Miller, remember, it only outlawed mandatory life without parole for juveniles. The Massachusetts court said, nope, not good enough. Based on their own state constitution, with that cruel or unusual wording, they said that both mandatory and discretionary life without parole for juveniles were unconstitutional.
Wow, so even if a judge thinks life without parole is the right call for a specific young person, Massachusetts says, no way, not allowed. That's a much stronger stance than Miller, right?
You got it. And they backed it up with all that science about adolescent brain development. They even said, and I love this quote, the brain of a juvenile is not fully developed. A judge cannot find irretrievably depraved.
Whoa. So basically saying you can't just assume a kid is beyond hope, that there's no chance they'll ever change. Powerful stuff.
It really is. And to drive home the point, they actually compared a juvenile life sentence to the death penalty, which is already banned in Massachusetts.
Interesting comparison. What was their thinking there?
They basically argued that sentencing a young person to die in prison is almost as bad as actually putting them to death. Both punishments are final, no chance for redemption. And given what we know about how kids can change and grow, they felt that kind of sentence was just way too harsh.
Okay, so the court makes this huge decision. What actually happened to Diachenko? Was he immediately set free?
Not quite. He wasn't automatically released, but the ruling did change things big time. The court said that anyone serving a mandatory life sentence for a crime they committed as a juvenile before 2014, they became eligible for parole after 15 years.
15 years. So a lot less than life, but still a significant chunk of time.
For sure. And for Diachenko, who had already spent over 30 years behind bars, that meant he could ask for a parole hearing right away.
Okay, so the possibility of freedom was back on the table.
Exactly. But it's important to remember, parole eligibility doesn't mean automatic release. The parole board still has to look at the individual's case and decide if they're no longer a danger to society.
Right. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. Did this whole Diachenko thing have any impact on the laws in Massachusetts going forward?
You bet it did. In 2014, the state legislature passed a new law that created different sentencing options for juveniles convicted of first-degree murder. Depending on the circumstances, they could be eligible for parole after 20 to 30 years.
So less harsh than that automatic life sentence.
Exactly. But there's a catch. This new law didn't apply to people sentenced before 2014.
Ah, so they're still under the old rules.
Yep. Their cases fall under the Diachenko ruling, which means parole eligibility after 15 years.
Makes sense. But wait, wasn't there a follow-up case to Diachenko? Something about Diachenko II?
Good memory. You're right, there was. Diachenko II came out in 2015. Basically, it clarified the rights of juvenile offenders during these parole hearings.
Okay, what kind of rights are we talking about here?
Well, for starters, it said that these folks have a right to a lawyer during their parole hearings.
That makes sense. Having legal representation is crucial in any legal proceeding.
Absolutely. And to level the playing field, the court also said that if someone can't afford a lawyer, the state has to pay for one.
That's important for fairness.
Right, and it went even further. They said these offenders also have the right to bring in expert witnesses, like psychologists, to testify about how they've matured and rehabilitated themselves, you know, to help their case.
Interesting.
And lastly, Diachenko II said that if a parole board denies someone's request for release, a judge can review that decision to make sure the board considered all the factors related to the person's young age when they committed the crime.
So basically adding some extra layers of protection and review to make sure these parole decisions are fair.
Exactly.
All right, so stepping back for a second, what are the big takeaways from this whole Diachenko saga? What does it tell us about how we approach juvenile justice and constitutional law?
I think one of the biggest lessons is how much our understanding of how young people's brains work is changing our legal system, especially when it comes to sentencing. It used to be like, okay, you did the crime, you do the time, regardless of age. But now courts are realizing that kids just aren't the same as adults, and that has to be reflected in how we punish them.
That's a huge shift in thinking. And it also really highlights how important state constitutions can be, right? Like in Massachusetts, they were able to offer even more protection than the federal constitution did.
For sure. It reminds us that states aren't just stuck with the bare minimum set by the federal government. they can create their own stronger safeguards based on their own values and ideas.
That's a really important point. So where does this leave us in terms of how we should be thinking about sentencing, especially for young offenders?
Well, I think Diachenko really forces us to grapple with some fundamental questions. Like, how much weight should we give to rehabilitation, especially when dealing with someone who committed a crime as a teenager? Can we really say someone's beyond hope of change just because of something they did when their brain wasn't even fully formed?
Those are really tough questions, and it seems like there's no easy answer, right?
Definitely not. Piachenko is all about finding that delicate balance between holding people accountable for their actions and recognizing that young people, even those who do terrible things, are still capable of change and deserve a chance at a better future.
That's a powerful thought.
It is, isn't it?
And on that note, here's something for everyone listening to ponder. How can we, as a society, balance the need for justice with the recognition that young people can change? It's a challenge that's going to continue to evolve as our understanding of the brain and our values as a society keep changing.